loaded. So my recommendation is that if you all can run through the course material, you know, every day when you all go back home, it will just keep you refreshed, and it will also absorb many of the content, you know, on a deeper level. So we'll just quickly revise what we did yesterday. Yesterday was day one, which was the search for happiness. And we began the discussion by saying that all of us are looking for happiness at some level or the other. And the kind of happiness we're looking for is many times confused, or many times a very flickering type of happiness that we generally experience. And most people in this world experience happiness, doesn't stay for long, but more than that, many people in this world experience that there's a pinprick in life where certain questions are not answered, and we do not experience what we are hankering for. And therefore, we went into the discussion of trying to understand what actually happiness is and how we can experience it. To begin the discussion, we discussed about a comparative analysis of humans and animals. Animals, we included all animals. And we saw that there are four common things between the humans and animals. The common things were, first one is sleeping. The second one is eating. Third one is enjoying. And the fourth one is defense. And we saw how people consider human beings to be special because they have a greater ability to do these four things in a much more polished way and in a much more appealing way. But then we realized that though a human being may be doing the exact same thing in a polished and an appealing way, but ultimately what he's doing is only sleeping, eating, enjoying and defending. And then we saw the Mahabharata verse, Ahara Nidra Bhaya Maitunam Cha Samanya Itad Parshubhi Naranam. And we saw how the difference between the human beings and animals is Dharmohi Tesham Adhiko Vishesho Dharmena Hina Parshubhi Samanam. We saw how without dharma, the concept of dharma in our lives, we are non-different from animals. In fact, the Mahabharata calls us as polished two-legged animals. And then we saw that what is the difference between a human being and an animal? Many people say that, you know, it's reasoning power or logical thinking, questioning power, so many things. But then we actually concluded that the actual difference between human beings and animals is A, B, C, and D. A stands for ability for higher inquiry. B stands for experiencing bliss. C stands for making the right choices. And D stands for determination. When we talked about ability for higher inquiry, we were talking about how, as a human being, we need to ask more questions than just for the seed. We need to ask more questions than just how to sleep better, how to eat better, how to enjoy better, and how to defend better. And when we ask these higher questions, like, for example, why am I suffering? What is the purpose of my life? Which direction is my life going in, though it is going very fast? So when we ask these questions, which are relevant and which are much higher than what an animal can think, then we actually are capitalizing on the potential of a human being, the ability for higher inquiry. And then we saw that there are four levels of bliss one can experience as a human being, which cannot be experienced as an animal. And these four levels of bliss are progressive in nature. And then we saw the highest level of bliss, which is bhakti ras, can be experienced in this world while we're living in this very same life. And how to do it is what we will continue discussing further. But the point is that an animal can never experience such bliss, whatever it tries. And then we saw also that animals inherently cannot make choices. They act by instincts. They do not have the choice to react or to withhold. But a human being has the Swatantra Ratna, which is the jewel of making the right choices. And if as a human being, we can take out our energy, time and focus and attention to make the right choices in life, then our life will become very fruitful. And then we saw how, as a human being, the ability to have the determination to do the A, B and C is impossible in an animal. And that's how a human being is special. And that is one of the potentials of a human being. And then we saw that all of us want to experience happiness, but why we don't experience happiness is because there are problems. And then we saw that problems are of two natures. One is a relative problem and one is a real problem. Relative problem is the one. What is the definition of relative problem? Anybody remembers? Okay. that's a good example. What is the definition of a relative problem? Yeah. One man's food is another man's poison. That is the definition of a relative problem. And when we solve the relative problems of life, then we experience relative happiness. So therefore, you know, somebody was just mentioning that the whole world is focused on trying to solve the real problem, relative problems, and not really trying to solve the real problems at all. And then we saw that if we want to experience real happiness, we need to solve the real problems of life. And then we defined what a real problem is. What is the definition of real problem? Common to all. No one wants it, but no one can avoid it. This is the definition of a real problem. And then we also saw that if you put it in this definition, these three things, then we saw what are the real problems of life. We saw there are seven in nature totally. Which are the seven? Birth, yeah, old age, disease, and death. And then natural disasters. Adi, we tell the Sanskrit definitions. Adi Atmik, which means body and mind, which creates problems. Adi Bhautik means other living entities create problems. And Adi Devik, which means natural disturbances. And then we saw that to solve these real problems, we need solutions. Then we saw how the world is providing us three temporary solutions, which are like painkillers, which really don't solve the problem, but only help us kind of experience a superficial solution. And what are the three painkillers or temporary solutions? First one is scientific advancement in sense gratification. Second one is speculation or mental trick. Third one is superficial religious rituals. So the example of scientific advancement promising sense gratification, we saw how people are saying that if you want to forget the problems of life, just engage yourself in, you know, either gadgets or some movies or music or food, and then you will not remember the problem at all, right? That is the first one. The second one is, what is it called? Speculation. And we give many examples of speculation of how different people recommend, like self-help books, then neuro-linguistic programming, so many of the others, where you are not actually tackling the problem at all, but you're giving a small relief to stress or anxiety. Many of these techniques do work. We do not say that they do not work at all. But what we say is that they do not approach the real problems at all. They are only handling the superficial solutions, right? And then we also saw how superficial religious rituals, they are also temporary solution. And generally, you know, superficial religious rituals never appeal to an intellectual person. And then we saw that what is the permanent solution? We told the story of this millionaire father who had lost his son in a fair. And the son was, you know, crying, and one person came and gave him some gadgets and some scientific technology, which really didn't make him happy. Another person came and gave him some pep talk, he gave him a lot of self-confidence, which helped for some time, but then it didn't really solve his problem. And the third person came and did some yajna, he did some religious rituals, which again didn't solve the problem. And the fourth person who actually came, he connected this this boy back to the millionaire father. And that millionaire father is God, and the lost son is all of us. And just like the son experienced happiness when he was connected back to his millionaire father, why? Because his father has everything. And only when he is in the safety of his father will he be satisfied and experience happiness. And then we concluded by saying that the permanent solution is if we can be somehow connected back to our real father, who is God. And then we saw how at this point of time, I'm making a statement that connect back to the real father. But then we don't know whether the father exists or no. That is what we will be studying today. And we also finally concluded by saying that we are looking for the right thing, which is happiness, but we're looking for it in the wrong place. And we saw that things in this world, matter cannot satisfy us. If matter could satisfy us, the richest man would be the most happy man. But unfortunately, we always see that people who have so much, not necessarily always satisfied, right? And people who have very little, many times are satisfied. So what is the secret of happiness? And then we saw how if you want to find the right thing, but if you find it in the wrong place, then you'll never experience it. That's what we concluded by saying that this world is called as Dukkhalai, which means a place of misery. And we are trying to find happiness here. Now, if we want to understand that there is a better place, then we need to understand whether the Father first exists. Therefore, we will start today's session by asking this question, does God exist? Now, this is a million-dollar question in many people's mind, because if you don't know that God exists, with what faith and with what confidence can we go any step further in spiritual life? Therefore, again, I would just like to repeat one thing. Generally, our experience has been that those who come to attend these six-session courses, the first 2 days seem quite basic. Many things you will find that, hey, I already knew this. Why did I come to such a course? But then, mind you, we are right now only on the surface of the ocean. The depths of the ocean has not even been revealed to you. The first 2 days, we generally, when somebody enters into a cold water, he's not very comfortable diving into it straight away. So, initially he has to just be given some kind of a slow experience of the water, and then he's put in, right? So what we are doing in the first 2 days is just giving you an experience of the surface of the water, and then we'll dive in. So, do not feel that this is too basic for us. Wait till the next day. But again, for us to be able to digest anything that comes ahead, you have to understand the basics very clearly. So, therefore, we spend sufficient amount of time clarifying the basics. And these are the groundwork for building up spiritual life. If the foundation is weak, then the building, it grows big, but then at some point of time it collapses because the foundation has not been laid properly. So now we will explore this question, does God really exist? Now, I want to ask all of you all this question. How many here believe in God? Once again, before you raise or don't raise your hand, I would like to tell you all that please be honest to yourself, because I told you that this is a journey of self-discovery. This is not a journey of, collective discovery, right? If it was a journey of collective discovery, you have to look at each other, whether this fellow is raising his hand or no. Because it is a journey of self-discovery, you have to look within, right? So my question is, how many here actually believe in God? Can put up your hand. Wonderful. Very honest. Thank you very much. So now, the question is, why? You can answer whatever you feel. Why do you believe in God? Whoever believes in God? Why do you believe in God? Any answer? Yes? Wonderful. Time and again we realize there is something beyond us. Yes? Okay. Okay. And we name that person who we can depend on as God. Good. Anything else? Yes? Wonderful. He said that most of the times when we focus on relative problems, you know, we try to find solutions. But when we talk about the real problems, then we turn to God. Okay? Anything else? Why do we believe in God? Anything else?
The world cannot be explained any other way.
The world cannot be explained in any other way. Wonderful. So, in summation, you know, there are four reasons why people believe in God, those who believe in God. One reason is because of desires. To fulfill desires, we need to believe in God. Many people believe in God so that desires can be fulfilled. If you find long queues in front of some temples, you know, you should always understand that inside the pocket there's a wish list, right? And the second reason why people believe in God is because of the fear of the unknown. There's something which we cannot know. So that fear generates a certain amount of belief in God. Another reason why people believe in God is because fear of society and peer pressure. You know, many times, you know, when we have discussions, like if I have to ask the same question, do you believe in God, standing in a discotheque, I'm sure nobody will raise up their hand, right? Because that's the wrong atmosphere. And there is a certain amount of peer pressure there, you know. So atmosphere and the kind of peer association that you have also creates a certain amount of fear in believing in God. And of course, one reason why people believe in God is because of traditions. People have certain traditions and certain amount of, you know, blind faith in the traditions. And we say that, you know, we have been trained like this, therefore we believe in God. So now, I want to tell you some very interesting stories. One man, he went and met a sadhu. You know, the sadhu would stay in the Himalayan jungles. Very famous and very, very austere saint. So this person, he decided to call this saint to his village and, you know, ask the whole village to hear him. So he called him, and the saint, he came. He didn't want to come, but somehow or the other he came. And the whole village was sitting in front of him. There were about 1,500 people in that audience. So the saint, he asked all of them this question. The same question that I asked y'all. How many of y'all believe in God? And interestingly, the whole village put up their hand. So the saint, he said, if all of y'all believe in God, then what should I speak? And he walked away. He went back to the jungles. And then, you know, they realized that they made a mistake. So they called him back. They said, one more time. So he came back and he asked everyone the same question. How many of y'all believe in God? All of them planned, and none of them raised their hands. So he said, if no one believes in God, I'm in the association of 1,500 atheists, I will get contaminated. And he ran back into the jungles. And then they called him another time. He said, last time. And then he said, how many of you all believe in God? The ones on this side didn't raise up their hands, and ones on this side raised up their hands. So he said, the ones on this side, explain to the ones on this side. And then he went off again. This is called as faith, which is based on circumstance. A very interesting thing happened many years back when I was in my engineering college. One boy, when, you know, we had a campus interview arranged, and the interview had just come. And one of my friends, he came running. You know, he was just running around the campus. So we asked him, why are you running? So he said, I am trying to look for a tikka, you know, some kind of a tilak to put on the head. So he said, you of all people, because this person was a confirmed atheist. He had absolutely no belief in God. So he said, you of all people believing in God suddenly? So he said, no, I will explain later. First give me. So somehow he found and he put on his head and he went and answered the interview and came back. So we asked him, what is the secret? You know, why did you do it? He gave a very interesting explanation. He said, when the interviewer was going in, I saw him. And he had a tikka on his head. So I realized that if I have to impress him, then I have to go with the tikka on my head. This is called circumstantial faith. Many people feel that believing in God might help in a certain advantageous way. I'll believe. And then at a certain situation, when believing in God doesn't help at all, why do I need to do it? Right? And many people have a very different conception. Like one of our devotees, he had gone to one opening of a clinic. It was a medical clinic. And one doctor, he was opening this clinic and he called all his friends. So they went and they were surprised that he had organized for Satyanarayan Puja in his, you know, as an opening. So this person, this devotee, he asked him that, why did you organize a Satyanarayan Puja of all things, you know? Because you have no faith in God. I've never seen you doing anything religious. So he said, this clinic has costed me a few crores. And he said, this Satyanarayan Puja is costing me 150 rupees. He said, if by chance God exists, you know, why to take chance? You know? In 150 rupees, he's satisfied and I'm also happy. You know? So many people believe in God or disbelieve in God because of these reasons. And then, why do many people not believe in God? Again, you know, anybody would like to say why people don't believe in God? Any reasons? Yes. This is wonderful. What is that? More of our anger. Okay. Yes. Seeing is believing. We can't see God. Where is he? Yeah, wonderful. You know, in the Bollywood movies, typically one scene is common in almost all the movies. At some point in the hero's life, you know, something really wrong happens. And then he suddenly goes into a temple, bangs the bell, and you know, somehow there's lightning, there's rain, and he's saying, Tum Bhagwan nahi ho, patthar ki murti ho, and you know, and then something happens. So this is the way in which people are trained to believe in God when everything is favorable, and to completely change our belief when things become unfavorable. And you know, there are three prominent or primary reasons why people don't believe in God. And we will try to answer these three reasons in a logical and systematic way. And that is what this whole discussion is going to be about. The first reason why people don't believe in God is, as she said, there is no proof for his existence. What is the proof? And the second reason we do not believe in God is because we can't see him. And because we can't see him, and because no one has seen him, why should I believe in him? And a third reason why people do not believe in God is because they ask, if God is really good, how can he allow so much suffering and evil to exist in this world? Therefore, I do not want to believe in him. So these are three primary reasons. And what we will do is we'll explore one reason at a time and try to understand whether God does exist. So the first reason is there is no proof for the existence of God. So now I'm going to spend... Yes? What we understand by the term God. That is, we have a definition of the term God later. You have to first understand whether he exists or no. Once again, please wait for some time, you will get the answer. Right? because I'm going in a certain flow. I can't take the PPT forward. Because there is one section in this presentation which says definition of God. And I'm going to give two definitions of God, which are conclusive definitions of who God is. Right? Can you wait for some time? So, the first thing that we need to understand is proof for the existence of God. So the first proof for the existence of God is C, which says creation implies a creator. So now I'm going to ask you all some questions. Can you name the inventor of this? Can you name the inventor of this? The steam engine. Can you name the inventor of this? Telescope. Galileo. Can you name the inventor of this? The light bulb. Thomas Edison. Now, can you name the inventor of this? Many times in life, we understand very clearly, every invention needs an inventor. One time, Isaac Newton, he had a friend in his house who came to visit him. And this friend, he entered the house of Isaac Newton, and he saw that on the table, there was a model of the whole solar system. And this model was a working model. So if you kind of move the pedal, the wheel, the whole solar system would rotate in a perfect way. So this friend was very impressed. And he asked Newton that, how did this, who made this? And what is the purpose of this model? So Newton, he said, this model, when I got up today morning, it just came by chance. And there is no purpose for this model. So this friend said, why are you fooling me? Is there anything that has come just like that by chance? And then Newton, he said, that this friend was an atheist, and Newton kind of made him understand that if you believe that the solar system, of which this is just a model, has come by chance, then why can't this model come by chance? And then his friend realized that it's logical. Because many things in this world, we find that there is nothing which has come from nothing. Everything has come from something. But when it comes to the whole universe, many times our understanding, even from the scientific point of view, is that it has come from nothing. I'll explain in detail. The study that we do in our school books and the college books is when it comes to the creation of the universe, we are explained that the universe has come from a Big Bang. What is the meaning of Big Bang? For those who don't know, I'll just explain in short. Big Bang essentially means that at one point of time, this is a 100% scientific theory. At one point of time, there was an infinitesimal point within which there was infinite mass, infinite pressure, infinite temperature, and at no time. They call that as no time. So now, such a model existed, and from that point, which is very, very minute, infinitesimal point, suddenly a bang happened. And then, as a result of the bang, there was a huge amount of mass thrown everywhere. And slowly, 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 all these masses started coming together and forming certain structures, shapes, and taking different patterns. And that is what the universe is about. Now, I'm going to tell you about a Big Bang construction company. So this construction company, it builds 100-story buildings everywhere. And the way they function is that wherever they want to build a building, they put a dynamite. And it's blown off, the dynamite is blown off. And then the next day morning, a beautiful 100-story building is constructed. Does it ever happen? Is it possible? From a explosion, do you ever find a construction happening? Whenever there is a bomb blast, do you find that, you know, when 10 people in a bomb blast are sitting together, the bomb blasts, and these 10 people die, and 11th person is created? Yeah. No, it never happens. Whenever there is a blast, there is destruction. There is no construction. And some very interesting things about the Big Bang. We'll analyze this Big Bang now in a deeper way. What it says is that everything begins from a point, infinitesimal point. Now, I'm going to tell you some axioms from science. Science has one very fundamental axiom. You know what's an axiom? Axiom means unchangeable truth. There are about 5 axioms in science, which any experiment of science, any theory of science, and any hypothesis of science has to fulfill. Otherwise, it is considered to be unscientific, right? Any scientific process, if it doesn't fulfill these axioms, then it is unscientific. One of the axioms of science is that every scientific experiment or any phenomena has to be explained with simple mathematical equations. This is one of the axioms of science. You can verify it with any scientist. One of the axioms of science is that any phenomena which science is propagating or promoting has to be explained with simple mathematical equations. But very interestingly, the Big Bang theory, which is explained, it is said to be 2 things. It is said to be physically indescribable and mathematically unverifiable. This is a scientific explanation. If you Google Big Bang theory and search Wikipedia, this is what Wikipedia presents. It is physically inexplainable and mathematically not verifiable. That means you cannot write a simple mathematical equation about the Big Bang at all. Which means that is actually not a scientific theory, but rather it is more about faith. Again, let us analyze. If everything began from a point, where did the point come from? Another question, that why it exploded only at that particular point of time? Why not before? Why not after? Right? Another question. Another question could be, who created the bang? You know, whenever we find some, you know, blasts happening anywhere, we know that there is a person behind the blast. You can never say, you know, the Japanese Hiroshima and Nagasaki blast happened just like that. You know, you cannot say that. Somebody has to take responsibility for every blast. And another thing is, whenever something has to explode, you know, it has to explode into something else. You know, like for example, if I keep a bomb here, and if the bomb has to blast, it has to fall into some space. You understand? It has to fall into some space. But when the Big Bang happened, there was nothing but an infinitesimal point. That means there was no space also existing. So if there was no space existing, where did it blast into? Right? And where did the space and time come from when it blasted into something? So now, all these are questions. And you never get answers to these questions. The way in which our school system, the college system, and the scientific system works is, if anyone, like I remember when we were studying this Big Bang theory in our school days, some of us asked our teacher that, how can you say this? This is actually nothing but blind faith in one sense. One person is saying, you know, the scientists are saying, everything came from a point. And the religionists are saying, everything came from God. The scientists are saying, you know, everything came from a point before which nothing was existing. And the religionists are saying, everything came from God before whom nothing was existing. What is the difference between the two? Because scientists are also saying it is mathematically indescribable, physically unverifiable. And here, the religion is saying, you cannot see God. But you can test by a certain amount of experience. And of course, I'm going to talk more logic later. But you're understanding what the point I'm trying to come to? The point I'm trying to come to is science has replaced God with a point. In essence, right? So now, if you understand it in that way, so the first understanding of the explanation of the proof of the existence of God is that every creation implies a creator. So now, if anybody wants to go into details of creation and creator, we can discuss for 2 hours, right? I can sit with you all and discuss about how we can more scientifically verify and discuss the Big Bang in detail. If anybody is interested in that, you know, welcome, we can discuss it. I can give you all more proofs from the scientific point of view. Like, I'll just tell you one more thing, you know, before we go ahead. For example, just now I told you about the creation of the universe. Now I'm going to tell you about the creation of life, right? This is a very simple and interesting fact about creation of life. I'm not going to go into details of it. I'm not going to go too much scientific jargons because not many of you all would be interested in it. But in essence, I'll tell you. There is something called DNA, which are the basic building blocks of life. Any life, in whatever form it may be, cannot exist without the DNA blocks. And what is DNA made up of? It is made up of protein molecules, intertwined together in great complexity. The interesting thing is that when creation began, you know, let us analyze it from the scientific point of view. When creation began, it is explained, without proteins, DNA cannot exist. And without DNA, you cannot form a protein molecule. Right? Anybody who has a scientific understanding, this is a scientific law. Now, the question is, when the creation of the universe began, you know, when you talk about that initial soup of chemicals, which they call it, which came first? Did proteins come first or did DNA come first? Which came first? That is the question. It is scientifically unexplainable. Right? So that means your basis of understanding of the creation of life is unexplainable. And then you build up on it. So you build up on a weak foundation. Right? And then the problem is that, you know, and this is a typical problem in the world today. When you go to a spiritual organization, you are told to ask questions. Do not accept anything without clearing your mind. Ask unlimited questions. These people have no work. They are there to answer all your questions. Ask them questions. And then when you enter into a science laboratory, we are scientists. No questions allowed here. Right? This is the problem in today's society. Where things that are common sense logic are considered to be perfectly true. Why? Because there's an authority called science, scientists who are saying that it is true. And the same authorities who are scientists, every research of theirs is changing over a period of time. Forget science. Even take our laws, today's laws. Even the law of our nation has been amended about 150 times till date. So that means everything is being amended, changed over a period of time, including scientific understandings. Therefore, of course, I'm not going to go into details of all that. Whoever wants to know more details, we can discuss it later. But then I'm going to go into the second understanding, the second proof for the existence of God. So the first proof was creation implies a creator. The second proof is laws imply a lawmaker. Whenever we find that there is a green signal, we go ahead. Whenever we find a red signal, we stop. Now, why do you stop when there is a red signal? Huh? It is a sign of danger. Okay. That's an interesting one. Anything else? Why we stop? Yeah, we've been trained that red signal means stop. Now, why are people scared to break a red signal? Why are people scared to break a red signal? Accident. Anything else? Violating the law. Fear of the law. Now, I'll ask you a question. Most of the times, when red signals are on, the police may not be standing there. Why you still stop? That's the law. That means, when there is a law which is made, there is a lawmaker who's making sure the law is implemented. You find that one time you break the signal, nothing happens. You try to break it second time, third time, and fourth time you get caught. Then you realize that somebody is observing me, right? In Singapore, there is a law that spitting is not allowed. If you spit on the street, within 10 minutes you get a fine. Why? You know, you think that people are honest, I just spat and they go and pay the fine? No. They have surveillance cameras which constantly monitor every nook and corner. Therefore, people get caught. And because the experience of being caught is there before, they never do it again. Which means that when there is a law and there is a lawmaker who is implementing that law, then people are careful of abiding by that law. So that means that whenever there is a law, it implies that there is a lawmaker who is making sure the law functions. Like for example, when we have, you know, hundreds of aeroplanes flying, do you think there is no system that makes sure that there is no clash? Is it just happening haphazard? You know, one time I was flying and there was a fog in one city, I think it was Bangalore, and the flight had to land in another state, and it went to Chennai, and we were stuck in the flight for 7 hours. Now I was wondering, what's happening? You know, these people don't have any intelligence. 7 hours are making us stuck in one place. Then I realized that because there are certain laws in place, why the laws are in place? To avoid accidents, to make sure that everything is smooth and functioning. We may not be able to see how it is being implemented, but because it is being implemented, we are safe, right? So laws always indicate that there is a lawmaker implying. And then we see, analyze the universe. You'll find that there is perfect harmony in the way in which the systems work. You find seasons perfectly changing in time. You find, you know, the sun always rising in time. You find the moon rising in time. You find so many things in perfect order. And then we also find that there are hundreds and hundreds of planetary systems. You never find, by mistake, two planets colliding against each other. Even if a comet collides against another planet, you can predict it 100 years before. You know, from today, I can predict when the next comet is going to collide against the Earth. That much precision. Now, when simple laws of traffic, it needs so much monitoring, it needs so much implementation, it needs so much of focus, attention to govern it, do you think these extraordinary laws of the planetary systems are happening haphazardly, without any power controlling it? Therefore, we understand that there is a lawmaker. We know that the law of gravity works. Newton discovered it. He didn't invent it, right? And before Newton discovered it, apples were falling. And after Newton discovered it, apples are still falling. Which means that there is somebody implementing those laws, right? We find the laws of physics, the optical laws, working perfectly. Refraction, reflection, it doesn't happen that for a change one day, light is not reflected. It never happens like that. Then people would lose faith in a mirror, right? We find the laws of mechanics perfectly working. And all these laws indicate that there is a lawmaker behind these laws. Now, a very interesting concept. This is the third proof. So the first proof was creation implies a creator. The second proof is laws imply a lawmaker. The third proof is organization and order indicates that there is a person organizing it. Like one time, one man came to India. He was a very rich and famous German person. He traveled India very extensively for a few years. And then he was returning back to his country, and a lot of people came to ask him, you know, what is the experience of India? And he said something very interesting, which caught the attention of the press. He said, when I came to India, I was an atheist. And now when I'm going back, I've become a theist. So people were surprised. Which guru did you meet? Please tell us. You know, which Baba gave you some medicine? Please tell us. And what did you see that gave you so much faith? He said, very simple. He said, when I was traveling India very extensively, I saw that in the government offices, nobody is working. People are smoking, people are drinking, people are, you know, enjoying themselves. Things are not functioning normally. Still, the whole country is running. I've got faith, now God exists. So, whenever there is an organization in a big scale, naturally there has to be somebody who's organizing it, right? So this man had a very interesting understanding of what organization means. Something very interesting about this perfection of organization of this world. Whenever there is a perfect organization, we always understand that there's a purpose for which the organization is happening. You know, you never find that people organizing a huge mega event without any purpose. Of course, it happens sometimes, but generally there is a purpose why people, you know, invest so much time in organizing. Like for example, let me tell you something. One boy, about an 8-year-old boy, he got up in the morning, and this is Christmas time. So he, next to his bed, he found a red stocking. He was, which is his favorite. He was looking forward to it, and then, you know, he thought, who must have kept this stocking? So he, you know, speculated. He was a small boy, 8-year-old boy. So one reason he came up with is, this has come just like that. By chance it has come on my table. Another reason he might speculate, you know, using his imagination, that some imaginary person called Santa Claus came and kept it on my table as a gift for me. And another thing he could be realistic and realize that the parents have organized to get this for me, right? So now, whenever you see an organization happening, you always understand that there is somebody putting his intelligence into organizing things. Just like one time, there was a student studying in a distant place and he was staying in a hostel. So his parents sent him a check, you know, for his expenses. So the postman came and gave him the check in his hand. Now, the student, if he concludes that the postman is such a nice person, he has come and given me such a lot of money. Is he right? No. If he thinks that the whole postal system is made so perfect that everyone gets money at some time or the other, is he right? He's not. If he puts his intelligence, he understands that his parents have earned so much money and they've taken the trouble to send him a check. He'll be grateful to them. So just like this boy, you know, received a check, the sender of the check was his parents. Actually, if you compare it in our lives, the sender is God. And the delivery boy, the person who comes and delivers it, is the whole universe, the way in which the universe is organized. And the check, the money, is the different gifts that nature is giving us. And just because the sender is out of sight, we cannot say that the sender doesn't exist, right? So the sender has taken so much amount of time and energy to make sure that that gift reaches us. And he uses the whole organizational setup of material nature to allow us to receive that check, right? So that is how we understand that, you know, any organization, whatever it may be, it requires some intelligence. Like for example, let us take the organization of an electricity. Now, I am getting, you know, supply from this electric board here. Now, do you think only this electric board is responsible for me getting power? No. Behind this electric board is a whole cable. And behind that cable is a tower. And the tower is running miles and miles connecting to a main powerhouse. And there are hundreds of people working and organizing the powerhouse to make sure that electricity comes to all our houses. Which means that any organizational setup cannot function unless there is a tremendous amount of organization ability of an organizer, right? Similarly, take the water setup. You can decrease the AC. So the question is, like, I'll show you some very interesting things. We have seen a light bulb functioning. We know that somebody has made the light bulb. But what about the light bulb which is there in nature? The sun. I'll tell you something very interesting about the sun. The sun, one ray of sunlight for 1 second, the amount of energy that one ray of sunlight emits for 1 second is enough to satisfy all the needs of human society from eternity till now. How much? One ray of sunlight for 1 second. That is the amount of energy the sun contains, right? And when we know that to make a 100 watt bulb, how much energy has taken, right? Thomas Edison, to make that 100 watt bulb, it took him 10,000 experiments to make one bulb, right? So that means he has put in so much of intelligence and energy to make that bulb happen. What about the sun, which is a mega, mega, mega bulb? A syntax tank is very easy for us to imagine and understand because we've seen it all over. But then, what about this syntax tank, the cloud? Lightweight, can hold millions of liters of water, and if an airplane passes through the cloud, it becomes two syntax tanks. And you never find that syntax tank leaking, right? So this is perfection in creation. This is perfection in organizational ability, right? So we never think about this organization. The fruity is something that we all drink. Packaged, easy, portable, you know, and easily available. And we do not think about the packaging of the mango, right? Portable, easily carryable, and very sweet. And, you know, you must have heard of citric acid, right? Citric acid, if you want to transport it from one place to another, is very dangerous because it can be very harmful. So therefore, it has to be packaged in certain, you know, really good containers. Now the same citric acid is available in a lemon. Small portable containers. You can carry it in your pocket, right? This is organization and order. So now the question is, does nature work by chance or does it work automatically? You know, can nature work on its own automatically? Just imagine, you know, I don't know how many of you all have seen automatic toys. I'm sure you must have seen automatic toys, right? If you know how an automatic toy works, can an automatic toy work forever automatically? No. So somebody in the previous time, somebody had to, you know, turn that knob from behind for a long time. And as much as the knob is turned, that much it will function. Then it will stop, right? But that means that even if something is automatic, for it to function, it will function unless there is somebody working on it. There should be some person organizing, only then it will function. Therefore, even in nature, you can never believe that something is happening automatically or by chance. There has to be somebody intelligent putting his intelligence to make sure it happens. So that is the third proof, organization and order. The fourth proof is a very interesting proof. This is called design implies an intelligent designer. Now, I'm going to tell you something very interesting about the giraffe. I don't know how many of you all know these facts. So the giraffe has a very interesting phenomenon. You have to try to understand the amount of design involved in the making of a giraffe. Okay? So giraffe has the longest neck. It has, you know, a huge neck. And now just imagine, you know, all of us have a heart to pump blood. You know, the heart is situated in a place where the blood can be pumped right to the head. Now the giraffe has a problem because it has such a long neck. So therefore the heart of the giraffe is a bigger motor. You know, it is 11 kilos in weight and 2 feet long. Now I'm going to tell you a situation. You know, you just imagine you have a motor which is so powerful, a heart which is so powerful, right? 11 kilos in weight and 2 feet long. That means it must be really pumping blood at a great speed. So imagine, and like for example, if you have a motor which is below, it's pumping water upwards. And if the motor is turned upside down and it is pumping water downwards with the same speed, it will go really fast, right? So when the giraffe is bending down to drink water, and if the heart continues pumping the blood at the same speed, what will happen? The blood will blow its brain out, right? Because the pressure in which it blows. Therefore, the heart of the giraffe has a one-way check valve. So what this heart does is that when the giraffe is standing, the valve is open and the motor functions and the blood flows to the brain. But when the giraffe is bent, the valve closes. And not just closes, you know, even if the valve is closed, the blood can, you know, break the valve and go out. But before the valve, there is a spongy tissue. So what the spongy tissue does, it absorbs, sucks the blood. It absorbs the blood and keeps it within it. And only allows that much blood to go, which is needed for the brain to function. And then when the giraffe's neck comes up again, then the spongy tissue squeezes the blood out and it sends it ahead. Now, do you think this happened by chance? Do you think this happened just like that? Darwin, if you study Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, there is a very interesting phenomena what Darwin speaks about. I'm not going to get into details of it, but I'm going to tell you a few examples. The theory of evolution, which says that the survival of the fittest, the best one survives. This is one theory that Darwin has come up with. And interestingly, The Origin of Species, which is the book of Darwin, it begins by the statement, I think. And then he proposes his whole theory. So it's his thought process. But anyway, about the giraffe, he talks about how a giraffe came into existence. He says that at some point of time, the deer were eating grass on the ground, and the grass on the ground got over. And then they had to take care of themselves. They had to evolve. So what they started doing was, they started reaching upwards. And slowly, 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 the neck developed. And then the deer became giraffes. That's a very easy explanation. But how do you explain such an intelligent design in it, right? This is the defect of understanding by the process of speculation. The design, it is not just on a micro level, but it is also on a macro level. If you study the way in which, if you take a leaf, just take one leaf of any tree, and if you use a microscope to go into it, you know, and study the leaf deeply, you will find that the leaf is perfect at the most deepest level. Even at the level of an atom, there is perfection in design. If you study microscopically any any living entity, any cell, you will find there is such an order, such a design at microscopic level. And if you go outside, zoom out, you know, go into the outer universe, you'll find perfection in design even there. So at a microscopic level and a macroscopic level, perfect design. How does it happen? If there is no designer, then naturally there would be mistakes. So therefore, you know, the reason why we say that we believe in God is because of these four things. What is the first thing I spoke? Creation implies a creator. What is the second thing I spoke? Laws imply a lawmaker. What is the third thing I spoke? Order and organization. Fourth thing? Design implies a intelligence designer. Now, you have to remember many of these examples that I gave in order to be able to understand what these mean. I gave the first one, creation implies a creator. What examples I gave? About the Big Bang, of course. And then I spoke about how different inventions, no invention can come without a inventor. And then second one, about laws imply lawmaker. What did I speak? Signals, flights, flying, so many others. And we saw that anywhere there is a law is implemented, the law of physics, the law of mechanics, you know, the law of gravity, you find that there is implementation. Implementation indicates the lawmaker. The third one, organization and order. I gave the example of government. Don't quote that. I spoke about the sun and the light bulb. I spoke about the mango and fruity. And I spoke about clouds, you know, which are perfect design. And then the last one, which is organization and the design. I spoke about the giraffe. And then I also spoke about on a microscopic and a macroscopic level, there is perfect harmony in design. Therefore, these four things are enough to make us believe that there is somebody existing who is controlling and governing and monitoring. We will call that person as God. So at this point of time, I'm not going into names, I'm not going into details, I'm not saying whether it is a he, it is a she, or you know who he is. I'm not telling anything like that. At this point of time, I only concluded that there is somebody called God. Now, the next question, want to say something? The next question is, very interesting question. I can only satisfy your question on day 5 because there are many concepts that are going to come in. The first fundamental concept is that it is our illusion to think that only in earth life exists. It is our illusion. And it is our unfortunate situation that we do not have access nor qualification to have access to higher planets. We may have spaceships that take us here and there, but really whether we have gone here and there, we don't know. Scientists may say it, but we don't know. You know, it's quite a debatable topic even now. So therefore, the first thing is that the life exists at every level. What to speak of anything else, even inside fire, there is life existing. There is something called fire bacteria, which is existing inside fire. If fire bacteria can exist within the fire, what makes us believe that inside the sun planet, there is no life? Right? So, one of the words that is used to explain life, it is called a sarvagata. Sarvagata means it is everywhere. So, it is many times our own limitation and many times our own arrogance which makes us believe that we are special and only here everything is there. You know, it's like if somebody is staying in some remote corner of an African jungle, and he doesn't know anything beyond that, you know, limited sphere of his. There was a story of a frog. And this frog was a PhD, Dr. Frog. And this frog, he was very proud of his knowledge because he knew the boundaries of his well perfectly. And he didn't know anything beyond the well. So one frog came from an ocean and he started bragging to the other frogs. You know, do you know I went to the ocean and came? Ocean is so big. So Dr. Frog got offended. He called him, either come here. I'll tell you how big the ocean is. The ocean is as big as this well. He said, you're a fool. The ocean is too big. He said, the ocean must be 10 times. Then he started blowing himself up, you know, to show how big it is. He said, no, much bigger. He started blowing more. It cannot be more than this. He said, no, it's much bigger. And then he blew himself so much that he blasted. You know? And then, what was the conclusion for the frog, for the Dr. Frog? Though he knew everything, but unfortunately, he didn't have the humility to accept that there is knowledge beyond our understanding. So many times, we come across things which will kind of completely bewilder us and completely take us to a different dimension only. Therefore, on day 5, I'll be able to do solid justice to your question, where I can explain creation with a diagram. Now we are going to structurally explain the whole of creation, the way the universal structure is explained to us.
Second question,
No, we don't say that human are a better creation. It is like this. Why is a CEO in a company given better facility than a pune? Why is he given a better mobile? Why is he given a better car? Why is he given a better facility? Simple. Because he knows to use that facility in a responsible way so that the whole organizational setup gets the benefit, right? So similarly, the human species is a species which is given that facility. Why? Because of the confidence that these people are going to use their life in a more responsible and a more dynamic way. But if you don't use the life in a more responsible and a more dynamic way, you get demoted. You know, you get kind of go back into the animal cycle. So therefore, human life is not, we're not proud that, you know, we're only discriminating in that way. But rather, we know that it is a facility. And therefore, right now, what we are doing is we are discussing how to use the facility best in the way that we are expected to. Make sense? So, again, you know, I think we'll keep the question answers towards the end so that, you know, the flow doesn't get disturbed. Otherwise, we'll just get lost completely. So, I'm here. You know, whatever questions you'll have, we'll answer them, but at a later point. So, right now, we are discussing, and of course, I do not want any of you all to forget any question that comes up. So please write it down, right? You can write down your questions and keep so that we make sure that we answer the questions. So, so at this point of time, we just proved that there is existence of God. Now, the question that comes up is that, can you show me God? Many people, you know, this is the second problem why people do not believe in God. That I cannot see God, therefore I do not believe in Him. So, we will try to understand this part. There is a theory called the theory of cause and effect. This is a very interesting theory which gives us some understanding of how we can learn to see God. So just like we have a fan, an electric fan which works. Now we see the fan rotating. Now a small child, when he sees the fan rotating, he is surprised, right? It's like a wonder. It's a great wonder, great miracle that a fan is rotating. But anybody who's intelligent, he understands why the, what is the cause for the effect, which is rotation. What is the cause? The cause is that there is an electric wire which is running, which is providing the electricity to run the fan. If somebody sees an arrow flying in the air, you understand that this is the effect. Then you study what is the cause. What is the cause? Somebody who is shooting the arrow. You study, you know, when you see puppets dancing. When small children see a puppet dancing, they are completely mesmerized. They don't understand where the voice is coming from. They don't understand how they are dancing. They're completely mesmerized. But then somebody who's intelligent understands that there is a puppeteer who actually makes the puppet dance. So similarly, there is a effect which is called the unseen is proven by the seen. Just like if you have a pearl necklace, and you know, when you see the pearl necklace, you see all the beautiful sparkling pearls on the necklace. But what you do not see is the thread, small thin thread that runs through the pearl necklace. That thread actually holds all the pearls in perfect place and harmony. But unfortunately, the thread is never recognized. The necklace is called pearl necklace or a gold necklace or whatever type of necklace, according to what is put on the string. But the string by itself is not really given the importance and recognition. So therefore, when you want to see the something that is unseen, it can be proven by something that is seen. So similarly, in this world, we want to see God. But at this point of time, we cannot see God. But you can see the effect that He is having on the creation. Just like I said, talk about laws being perfectly implemented. We spoke about how design is perfect. We saw organizational ability. We saw about how creation is happening. So when we see all these things, we understand that there is somebody who is doing it. So therefore, the unseen is proven by the seen. What you see, it helps you to understand the unseen. Now, the next question is it possible at all that we can see God directly, face to face? Is it possible? So there are three things that we need to remember if at all we want to see God directly, the first thing we have to understand and ask ourselves is, are we qualified? You know, do we have the qualifications to see God? Like, for example, I'm sitting here in South Bombay. I might say that I want to see the Prime Minister tomorrow, okay? Who cares? Right? Am I qualified, first of all, to see the Prime Minister? If I'm qualified, then I'll be able to see him. But if I'm not qualified, I might talk 100 different things. Why will he come in front of me? Right? I can say that if the Prime Minister doesn't come tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock in the temple, he doesn't exist. Who cares? Right? So first thing is, we have to develop our qualification to see God. The second thing is that we have to follow a process. Only when we follow a process will we be able to find the effect. You know, like, for example, there was a boy in a science classroom, and the science teacher, she told the students in the class that when you combine two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of oxygen, you get water. The student said, impossible. I don't believe you. The teacher said, you come with me to the laboratory. I'll show you. He said, I don't come. I know you're going to brainwash me. And, the teacher said, I will show it to you physically if you come here. She said, I'm scared of, the student said, I'm scared of you. You are a preacher. You're not a teacher. So, the same thing it comes to when you want to see God. Somebody, he tells you that if you want to see God, there's a process. You combine two molecules of hydrogen, one molecule of oxygen, and then it works. You tell him, I don't believe in you. And if somebody tells you, you follow this process, I can show it to you, it'll happen. He says, no, you're brainwashing me, I don't want to come next to you. Right? This is exactly how you understand a water molecule being formed. Similarly, you can understand that you can see God. But first thing is that you need to follow a process. And the third thing, which is a very important thing, is that we have to achieve the purification of the mind. At this point of time, the mind is so contaminated that we can't see ourselves properly. The mind is like a mirror. It reflects whatever you see. But if the mirror is dirty, even if you look into the mirror a whole day, you can't see anything. Why? Is it the problem with the person who is looking? Is it the problem in the mirror? Because the mirror is dirty, right? So the mind needs to be cleansed. Like, for example, there was a man who was, very confident about how he is. So he went to a teacher and he asked his teacher that, I know a lot of things about spirituality. Can you also teach me a little more? The teacher asked him, what do you know? He said, I know this, I know that, So teacher asked him, do you know how to control your mind? He said, yeah, that's very easy. So the teacher told him, I'll tell you a small, thing that you need to do. Just go and do it, come back. You tell me how you feel. And what is your experience? So this man, he said, no problem, I'm ready to do it. So the teacher told him, listen very carefully. The teacher told him that go home, sit in one place for 1 hour. Close your eyes and don't think of a red monkey. So the student, he said, such an easy thing. I don't think I've done anything easier than this. So he went back home, closed his door, closed his windows. He sat in one place, closed his eyes, and he was trying not to think of a red monkey. And then after 1 hour, he was completely frustrated because the only thing that was coming in his mind was red monkey. Then he came back running to the teacher. He said, what have you told me to do? The teacher asked him, what happened? So he said that I tried to not think of the red monkey for 1 hour, but the only thing I could think of was a red monkey. So the teacher told him, now you understand what is your position. So with so much of contamination in the mind, we want to try to see something which is pure. So therefore, the third thing that we need to do to develop our ability to see God is purify ourselves. So when we can do all these things, then we'll be able to actually physically see God also. But till then, we can safely conclude that the unseen is proven by the seen. Now I'm going into the definition of God. This is a very important part of this discussion, because if you understand this nicely, then you can, whatever I'm going to speak ahead in the fourth session, you know, will make a lot of clarity if you understand the definition nicely. Different people have different conceptions of who God is. Like, for example, if I ask you all, what is a medulla oblongata? How many people know what's a medulla oblongata?
It's a part of the brain.
Some people know. Yeah. So how much can you speak about it? Can you speak about it for 1 hour? You cannot speak about it. But if somebody is a doctor, especially if he's a neurosurgeon, he can speak for 3 days probably about medulla oblongata. But if I ask, you know, a neurosurgeon, you know, tell me about the CMOS semiconductor, he will faint. He doesn't know what a CMOS semiconductor is. But if I ask an electronic engineer, he can speak for 1 hour about CMOS semiconductor. And, you know, if I ask somebody about diagonal matrices, you know, a mathematics wizard may be able to speak for 2 hours and solve 20 diagonal matrices. But somebody who doesn't know, he will not understand. Or if I ask somebody, what is artichoke? Somebody who doesn't know cooking doesn't understand what it means, right? But if I ask anybody on the street, what do you understand about God? Every person can give a 10-hour lecture about what he understands about God. If somebody needs to have a doctorate to understand a medulla oblongata nicely, if somebody needs to understand diagonal matrices having mathematics degree, if somebody needs to have an electronic degree to understand a CMOS semiconductor, does a person need no qualification to understand and explain about God? Is God such a cheap and such a easy thing that anybody and everybody can explain unlimitedly whatever he feels, and that's what God is? This is the problem with us. Because even if you want to understand who God is, there is a system to understand. And there is a systematic understanding of who God is. And if anybody on the street is asked who God is, and that person is taken as an authority, then you end up understanding nothing. Therefore, we need to spend time in systematically understanding who God is. And that is what we will try to do. Many people say God is light. Is he a tube light, neon light, you know, sunlight? What light is he? No understanding. Some people say that, you know, like one person, I think this is Newton, he came up with this theory that God is like a watchmaker. The watchmaker makes a watch, and then he has nothing to give and take with the watch. He's gone. You never find, you know, you're not going to run after one watch. So God made the universe, but then he ran away because it went out of control. You know, some people speak like that. Some people say that God is dead. There was a person called Nietzsche, and this person, he actually believed that God is dead. And he would write everywhere, you know, God is dead, especially in front of a church, you know, he'll go right at the wall of the church. And then after some time, some years, Nietzsche died. And somebody wrote, you know, where he wrote, God is dead, Nietzsche, he signed. And the priest wrote below, Nietzsche is dead, God. So what is the right understanding of God? And there was one person who came to our temple many years back, and he was arguing with one of our leaders. He said that, I am God, you are God, everybody is God. So this person, this leader, he was trying to explain that you are not God, I am not God. There's only one God. He was trying to explain, this person was not understanding only. Arguing left, right, center. After 2 hours of argument, this man, he said that, can I use the toilet? Is there a washroom somewhere? So this leader, he said, you are God, you should find it, you should know where it is. So he said, no, please tell me, it's urgent. So he said, if you are God, at least try to control it. You are the controller of the whole universe, control your boils. He said, no, this is not the time for jokes, please tell me. You know, and then after some time, nature started screaming. And then this leader, he took him to the washroom. And he told him before he entered, Do you claim, do you believe and do you accept that you are not God? He said, yeah, I'm not God. He went in, he answered nature's call and he came out after some time. So then this leader asked him, so you're not God, right? He said, no, I'm God. So he was surprised. What is this? In 2 minutes, everything changed. He said, that was my leela. That was my pastime. So people have such weird understandings of who God is that they're completely confused. So now we are going to see a concrete definition of God. So the first, there are two definitions. This is the first definition. The first definition is that he is a supreme source of everything. Now, what do you mean by the supreme source of everything? Just like you have water. Water, when it comes out from a tap, you know, people who don't know the source of the water feel that water is coming out from the tap only. But actually, those who know the science understand that the tap is connected to a pipe, which is connected to a huge pipe, and which is connected to the river somewhere else. And then the source of that, you know, the water is not actually the pipe or the tap, but rather it is the river. So similarly, if you start seeing the connection, not the immediate connection, but rather the distant connection, you understand what it means by the supreme source. I'll explain more. Just like when nowadays, you ask children, where do you get milk from? They say, you get from the supermarket. Where do you get milk from? You get it from a cow, right? But people don't understand that the source of the milk is the cow. Or for example, if a small child is born, or all of us, you can take. Who is our father? You can name so and so. Who is his father? You can name so and so. Who is his father? You can name so and so. And then when you go back on and on and on and on, you reach one person who has no source. That is God. Now, how do you understand it? You know, how do you understand this more concretely? The Bhagavad Gita defines God as Aham Sarvasa Prabho Matas Sarvam Pravartate. That means that he is the source of everything in this world. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence and ego. The one who is the source of all these things is considered to be God. And many people ask this question that if everything is created by something or from something, surely God also must be created by somebody. So if God is created by somebody, that person becomes God, right? So God is someone who is not created by anyone else. And now what to speak of God? If somebody knows the laws of physics, there is a law called law of conservation of matter and energy. You know, this law is very simple. This law says that matter and energy can never be created nor destroyed. It can only be transformed from one type to another type. If matter and energy cannot be destroyed and created, what to speak of God, who is the creator of matter and energy, right? So we are, and having a scientific understanding, we understand that matter and energy also, it cannot be destroyed, nor can it be created. That means it is eternal, which means that the one who is creating matter and energy has to be eternal, right? And, again, another understanding also is that whenever you see creation, it means it started at some point of time. But if there is a God who is a creator, he has to be before that point of time. That means God has to be, he is the one who created time and space. So before him, time and space wouldn't exist. And from the time he created it, time and space started existing. Now, another question is why we cannot see him now? Why we cannot see the creator now, if he is actually existing. I'll give you a nice example. Like for example, if you study a novel, there's so many novels available in the market. If you study a novel, and if somebody says, can you show me the author in the novel? Can you show the author in the novel? You cannot show. The author, he has created the story, he has created the characters, he has created the timeline, but he's out of it, right? So God is like an author, and the creation is like a novel. The author has created this novel, he has created many characters within the novel, and he started a timeline. But he doesn't have to be involved in the novel. He's out. He's creating another novel somewhere else, right? That's God. And, you know, many times when you talk about this concept of eternity, you know, God is eternal. You know, he was always existing. Many people have a doubt. He said, how can we understand the concept of eternity? Because why we cannot understand it is because we are conditioned to time and space. We are conditioned to time and space. That means for us, anything has to begin somewhere and everything has to end somewhere. That is how we are created. That is how we function. Therefore, when we say God is eternal, antenna starts, you know, how it is possible. Because we cannot imagine what is being eternal, right? Therefore, let me ask you all a very simple thing, just to make you all understand this fact better, that we cannot understand the concept of eternity ever. Think of the largest possible thing you can imagine. You know, what is the largest thing you can imagine? Think. What is the largest thing you can imagine? The biggest thing you can imagine?
An ocean.
Okay.
Universe.
What else? Air. Okay. What else can you imagine? The largest thing you can imagine. Stretch your imagination more.
Love.
Okay. What else? Some numbers, somebody into mathematics. What is the largest number you can imagine? Infinite. Anything else? So even just what I'm trying to tell you, okay, try to imagine the smallest thing possible. Smallest, how much small you can imagine? Small point. What else?
An atom.
Okay, what else? A drop of water. So now you try to understand what I'm bringing about. Our imagination, the smallest, the biggest or the smallest, is still confined to a certain extent. We cannot think also beyond a certain extent. That means, how can we think about the concept of eternity when our mind and our whole existence is programmed to think only about a certain amount? We cannot think beyond a certain amount, right? Because that's how our conditioning is. And we are trying to understand something that is eternal. Therefore, how much ever we try, we will never be able to understand the concept of eternity. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, right? So, I'm going to speak this definition of God. There are four points in this first definition of God. The first point is supreme source of everything. Let us take an example of a construction of a house. Right? So now, to construct a house, what do you construct a house from? Earth, water, air, ether, you know, these are the materials, basic building blocks you construct earth from. So when we say God is the supreme source of everything, that means he is the one who is providing us all those basic building blocks. He is the one who is providing us air, he is the one who is providing us the earth, he is the one who is providing us water, he is the one who is providing us all these things. So when we say he's a supreme source, that means he is the one who's creating all these things, right? So that is the first concept. So the second concept of God is he is the supreme proprietor of everything. Now this is something very interesting, the concept of proprietorship. One time, Akbar and Birbal, they were discussing something, and Akbar was very proud, you know, about his abilities, and he started telling, you know, all his ministers about how powerful he is and how he is conquering the whole world, so many things. So Birbal realized that he has to teach him a lesson. So Birbal, he told him, in one of the comments, all the ministers were praising Akbar. So one of the comments Birbal said, "You are so great, your highness, that you are bigger than God, you are greater than God." And Akbar immediately became very angry. He said, "How dare you say that? You are blaspheming God. You will be punished. If you cannot prove your statement, then you will be punished." So Birbal said that, and then Akbar also said that, you know, if you act like this, I will throw you out of my kingdom. Birbal said, Just see, I told you, you are greater than God. Because even if God wants, he cannot throw me out of the kingdom. Because his kingdom is everywhere, right? And he said, therefore you are greater than God. You can do something that God cannot do. So the concept of proprietorship is such a funny concept in this world that people are there for a limited amount of time with a limited amount of things and with a limited amount of control, they feel that they are the proprietors of the whole world. You know, typically when you travel in a local train, one time I was traveling and I saw something very interesting. There were two people who had gone into, the train from one station. And then, one person sat on the seat, the other person didn't get a seat, he was standing. And then this person who was sitting, he got up to put his bag on top. And the other fellow sat down. And this person whose seat was taken away, he got angry. He said, how dare you do this? This is my seat. And then they started fighting. He said, what seat you're talking about? You're not born here. This is my seat. Now I'm sitting on it. They started fighting on and on and on and on. It went from seat to, so many things. And then they continued fighting. And then both of them realized that the station has come. They got down from the train. And in the station, they continued fighting. The train went away. The seat is gone. Train is gone. But still they're fighting. So people in this world have a concept of proprietorship. But without understanding the fact that we ourselves are so limited. And therefore, whatever we claim to be ours is always so limited. And more than limited, it is for a temporary amount of time. Small fraction of time. It is not there forever also. One time, there was a saint who wanted to teach a king, something about life and something about understanding of who he really is and how he should be very careful about how he handles his life. So this saint, he went to this king and he told him that I have a bad news for you and I have some good news also. The king said, tell me the bad news first and then you can tell me the good news. So the saint said, the bad news is that you're going to die in 7 days. The king became, completely sad. He said, now tell me at least the good news. So he said, the good news is that after death, you'll go to the heaven. He said, wow, that's a good news. Then he said, but there is a bad news also. He said, in the heaven, the population is exploding like anything. So the king became sad. And then he said, but there is a good news also. The good news is that in the heaven, you'll have a palatial building for yourself. He said, wow. And then he said, but there is a bad news about that also. You will have your own palace, but there are hundreds of mosquitoes there. The king became extremely sad. He said, my God, what will I do in a palace filled with mosquitoes? He said, but there is a good news. That palace, there are many mosquito nets. He said, wow. And then the saint said, there is a bad news. The bad news is that all the mosquito nets have holes in them. The king was again, sad. And they said, there is a good news also. That there is a lot of thread available over there. So you can stitch it up. So he said, brilliant idea. So then the saint said, but there's one bad news. The bad news is that there's no needle over there. So the king was so sad. He said, tell me a solution now. The saint said, very simple. Take a needle with you. And then the saint went away. The king, he said, wow, what a solution he gave me. And he was thinking for some time. And then he realized, my God, he called the saint back. He said, oh, Sadhuji, you told me to take a needle. How can I take a needle? The saint said, that's what I'm trying to explain to you. You are, spending your whole life in earning unlimited amount of wealth and money, conquering kingdom after kingdom. But after you die, you cannot even take one needle with you. So people are wanting proprietorship in this world. But actually, nobody is a proprietor of anything. The only thing that we are, is we are caretakers. That too for a temporary amount of time. We cannot be caretaker forever also. Being a caretaker forever also is a problem, right? Only God is a person who is a supreme proprietor. Forever, he is a proprietor. That means, when the building is built, now I was telling you, when the building is built, what we use? All the ingredients. Who supplies the ingredients? God supplies. Just imagine, somebody who's constructing a house. And if the architect who constructs the house says that I own the house now, how does he own the house? The one who has provided the ingredients owns the house, right? So God is the one who is providing all the ingredients. Naturally, he is a proprietor. Therefore, one time, Srila Prabhupada, the founder of ISKCON, he went to one, he met Alfred Ford. You know, he's the son of, grandson of, great grandson of Henry Ford. First thing he asked him, they introduced him, saying that, you know, this is Alfred Ford, the great grandson of Henry Ford. The first thing he asked him is, where is he now? Henry Ford, where is he now? Kind of straight brought to the reality of life that people, you may have big, big names claiming yourself to be proprietor of so many things, but how much time does a proprietorship last, right? The land for which people have fought, the land is still here, but the people are gone who have fought for the land, right? And the land will continue to remain here. So therefore, the concept of supreme proprietorship is when we understand that God is actually the proprietor of everything that exists. And that brings us to the third definition, third concept of the second same definition, the supreme enjoyer, which means that the one who is actually the source of everything, he becomes a proprietor naturally, and naturally he has the right to enjoy all the facilities. Now, if somebody has built a house and it's his own ingredients, and he has made sure the house is built, and he's a legal proprietor of it, naturally he can do what he wants inside the house. Therefore, he is considered to be a supreme enjoyer. And the most important thing, why is God a supreme enjoyer? Because his enjoyment is independent of anything else. Because he is self-satisfied. He is Atmaram. And he is so much full of pleasure that he can share his happiness with others. And in today's world, if you take the example of, if you want to understand this concept of enjoyer better, take this example of a hotel owner and a servant who is working in the hotel. The hotel owner owns the hotel, but the servant, he works in the hotel, he seems to be enjoying the same facility as the owner. He gets 3 times food, you know, he gets to stay in the hotel all day long, everything. But at the end of the day, the key remains in the pocket of the hotel owner. And more than that, he's the one who is actually enjoying. But the servant, you know, that means the hotel owner is an independent enjoyer and the servant is a dependent enjoyer. The day the servant, he starts asking questions. He says, why only you have to take all the money? I am only working so hard, you know. That day his enjoyment is gone. Therefore, the servant is a dependent enjoyer, but the owner is a independent enjoyer. So this is the third understanding. And the fourth understanding is that God is the supreme controller. Human beings are tiny controllers. We can control a family, we can control a state, we can control a government, we can control a nation. Many times it is difficult to control even one family, you know. So people like to exhibit this controllership a lot. You know, one man, he said that I am the master of this house and I have my wife's permission to say this. So controllership also in this world is a very limited controllership, how much ever we can. Just like when a cow is tied to a pole, you know, and there is a rope which ties the cow to the pole. And the cow can move around as much as the rope permits him. Beyond that, the cow cannot move. And within that, the cow has freedom to go, you know, closer to the closer to the pole or further from the pole. But within that limit. So similarly, all of us are controllers to some extent. To the extent that rope is there. Some people have big rope, some people have small rope. Some people have, the rope is tied practically to the pole only. You can't even move your head, right? And some people have a little bigger rope. But everybody is tied with the rope. And that is the range of control that we have. And you know, the person, there was one man who wanted to serve the supreme controller. So he was trying to explore. So this man, very sincere in his heart, he wanted to serve somebody who was really the supreme controller. So he went to, you know, he was in a village. So he went to the zamindar who was actually owning a lot of land. He asked him, I want to serve the supreme controller. So zamindar seemed to be a very powerful person. So he said, can I serve you? He said, of course you can serve me. After some time he saw that the king's guards are coming to take tax from the zamindar. So he realized that somebody is more powerful than the zamindar. So he jumped and he started serving the tax collector. The tax collector is very powerful. So then after some time, the tax collector was reporting to the king regularly. So he realized the king is more in control. She started serving the king. And one day, he saw that, you know, a saintly person came to the king's palace. The king started, you know, falling on the floor, worshipping him. He said, this saintly person is better. So then he went to asked the saintly person, I want to serve somebody who is a supreme controller. Who should I serve? He directed him towards God. And this man, he actually went and started serving the temple because he had a desire to serve somebody who is a supreme controller. And therefore, as I said, that God is the one who is the supreme source of everything. That means he creates all the ingredients. Using that ingredient, you build a house. Naturally, he becomes a proprietor of the house. And when he is a proprietor of the house, he can naturally enjoy all the facilities in the house. And naturally, he becomes a controller also. That means, in a house, if you want the photo to be on this side, or the photo to be on this side, the person who is actually in control of the house can do it. Right? He can change situations. So similarly, the laws in this world are made by God. And because he is the one who is in control, he can change the laws according to his needs and according to his desire. Just like inside a house, anybody can change anything according to his will and desire. So this is the first definition of God. What is the first definition? Supreme source of everything, supreme proprietor of everything, supreme enjoyer of everything, and supreme controller of everything. The first definition. The second definition of God is, now I'm going to ask you questions. What is a wealthy person called in Hindi? Dhanwan. I'm not asking names. What is a strong person called? Shaktiman, Balwan. And what is a learned person called? Vidwan. And who is a person who possesses Bhaga? The word Bhaga means opulence. Somebody who possesses Bhaga is called as Bhagavan. The word Bhaga means opulences. Now, what is the meaning of opulence? There are 6 opulences in this world. If anybody has any of these 6 opulences, he is considered to be really powerful and really great. And people want to worship him. So the first opulence is wealth. The second opulence is strength. The third opulence is beauty. Very interesting thing about beauty. This is before 6 beers. And after 6 beers, the definition of beauty changes. So beauty is something that attracts. Then knowledge. Somebody who is knowledgeable, he is considered very attractive. Somebody who is very famous, he is considered to be attractive. And somebody who is renounced is also considered to be very attractive. So, So the 6 opulences: wealth, strength, beauty, knowledge, fame, and renunciation. These are the 6 opulences. If anybody has these 6 opulences, even in a minute extent, he is considered to be very attractive. And the definition of Bhagavan means somebody who has all the 6 opulences in full, he is called Bhagavan. That means God is all wealthy, he is all knowledgeable, all beautiful, all famous, all renounced, and all strong. That means if any one person has all these 6 qualities in full, that person is God. He cannot even have one of these in a little lesser quantity. In this world, we see that there are many rich people, but intelligence sometimes less. There are many strong people, beauty sometimes less. There are many beautiful people, wealth sometimes less. There are many, you know, knowledgeable people, but renunciation very less. There's a lot of pride. There are many people who are very renounced, but fame less. We find people having different qualities in great quantity, but either 1 or 2, maximum 3. You never find one person having all the 6 qualities, and the 2 in full, not in less quantity. You know, anybody can say, I am looking beautiful, but others also should feel it, right? Anybody can say, I am the richest man in the world, but he doesn't have the wealth of his neighbor. When I say all wealthy means he is the one who possesses wealth of everyone put together, right? So if anybody has all the six opulences in full, he is called as Bhagavan. That we will discuss who is that Bhagavan later. But at this point of time, these are two definitions of God. First definition is supreme source, supreme proprietor, supreme enjoyer, and supreme controller. The second definition is one who is Bhagavan. Bhagavan means one who possesses six opulences in full. What are the six opulences? Wealth, strength, beauty, knowledge, fame, and renunciation. Wonderful. So if anybody has these two, can fulfill these two definitions, he is God. Now, this is the most important part of this whole presentation. Acquiring knowledge about God. Now we have understood so much that God exists. We also understood that, you know, we know what is the definition of God now. But now the most important thing is, how do I acquire knowledge about God? And this, what we are going to discuss, is going to be the foundation for tomorrow's whole discussion and next 4 days of discussion. If you don't understand this concept nicely, you may kind of flip out in the remaining sessions. Okay? So we will try to understand how to understand or acquire knowledge about God. So there are three ways of acquiring knowledge about God in this world. The first way of acquiring knowledge about God is called as pratyaksha praman. So this word comes from prati aksha. What is the meaning of aksha? Aksha means to see. Prati aksha means I want to see. You know, whatever I see, I believe in it. That is called prati aksha. That means anything I want to understand, or I will accept something as knowledge only when I can see it and experience it. That means whatever I can experience and see, experience using my five senses, the eyes, the ears, the mouth, and the touch, the taste, this is what I'll accept as a truth. I'll not accept anything beyond this as a truth. This is called as pratyaksha praman. This is the first way of gaining knowledge. But this way of gaining knowledge is a very defective way of gaining knowledge. I'll tell you why. Because we are depending a lot on our senses, right? But the senses have four defects in them. All our senses have four defects. The first defect is that they are imperfect. The second defect is that they have a tendency to get illusioned. The third defect is that we have a tendency to commit mistakes. And the fourth defect is that we have a tendency for cheating. Let me tell you again. First defect is that we have imperfect senses. Second defect is that we have a tendency to be illusioned. Third defect is that we have a tendency to commit mistakes. And the fourth defect is that we have a cheating propensity. Now let me quantify what these four mean. The first defect, what is it? Imperfect senses. All our senses are imperfect. How? We cannot see anything beyond 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. Anything beyond the visible spectrum, we can't see. If, you know, and many times in the night, you will find that dogs are barking, you know, very loudly. And we don't know why they're barking. They can see something that you can't see, right? Why? Their spectrum is higher. If something is there in the infrared rays, we can't see it. If I pass an infrared ray here, you can't see it. Why? Your eyes are not trained to see that. Similarly, our tongue. Similarly, our nose. And our hearing. We can only hear between 20 and 20 kilohertz. We cannot hear anything beyond that. If I blow a dog whistle over here, you cannot hear the dog whistle. But the dogs will come running in the street. Right? Why? Our frequency is less. Similarly, touch. Similarly, the taste. Like for example, if I taste an orange after I eat sugar, then what happens? The orange will taste sour. But if I taste the same orange after I, you know, put a few drops of lemon, then the orange will taste sweet. So similarly, all our senses have these defects. And the second one is the tendency to be illusioned. We have a tendency to get illusioned. Like for example, I'll give you a simple example. This is perfectly applicable for all the senses, but I'm only telling you about the skin. We're running short of time. If there's something called dry ice, how many of you all have heard of dry ice? You know, this is solidified carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. If you rub dry ice on your skin, you will actually feel a burning sensation. But actually, your skin is not burnt at all. Why? We have a tendency to be illusioned. I'll show you something very interesting. What do you all see on the screen? Huh? Somebody playing a guitar? Can you see an old man and an old lady? Illusion. That's the point. This means that we have a tendency to be illusioned. You can see something. What can you see? They're moving. Nothing is moving. It's a stationary screen. Our eyes have a tendency to get illusioned. Our tongue has a tendency to get illusioned. Similarly, our hearing. Now, if I hear outside, you know, there is a fight going on, you know, and I'm disturbed completely. But when I open the door and if I find that somebody is playing a movie and the fight is going on within the movie, you'll never know the difference between an actual fight and something that is going on in a movie, right? So our ears have a tendency to be illusion. Similarly, all our senses have a tendency to be illusion. And the third thing is that we have a tendency to commit mistakes. I'll tell you one example. There are hundreds of examples of how every human being makes hundreds of mistakes. Earth was considered to be flat at some point of time. And people were actually believing in it completely. And there was a time when people would be warned, don't travel too far. If you travel too far, you will fall, you know, because it ends somewhere. And there was somebody called Hubble, one scientist. He invented a yardstick to measure astronomical distances. And he called it as the Hubble's constant. It was one number. And that number had to be used for all the astronomical calculations, multiplications and all that. Some years later, somebody found out that this man made a mistake in the calculation. The number was something else only. So they changed it. So the Hubble constant became something else. After a few years, somebody else found there is a mistake in that also. They changed it. They changed it so many times that now it is called as Hubble's variable. That means this is a tendency to commit mistakes that every human being has. To err is human, we say. That means we cannot get perfect knowledge with our senses. And the fourth defect is the cheating propensity. Because we have imperfect senses, we get illusion. Because we get illusion, we commit mistakes. And because we commit mistakes and we have a big ego, we cover it up by cheating. And, you know, there was a man called, when this Darwin's theory was being propagated, there was one thing which is called the missing link. You know, he was talking about how ape evolved into human beings. And there was one particular bone which was the kind of the missing link between an ape and a human being. And if that bone was discovered, Darwin's theory was proved. At least that's what they were claiming. And suddenly, one man, one scientist, he discovered the missing link. And it became a history. And all the science books, it was there. And then this, you know, the missing link, this bone, this jawbone, which looked exactly like the missing link between the human and the ape, was kept in a museum for years. And after almost 40 years, they realized that this man had cheated. He'd taken a human bone and sought and kind of filed it to look like that missing link. And then the whole theory collapsed. Why did he do it? Name and fame, right? He got a lot of name and fame at that point of time, but at the cost of what? So therefore, we have a tendency to commit mistakes and then we have a cheating propensity. Therefore, our understanding of the truth cannot be perfect. Again, this is another illusion. So the second way of acquiring knowledge is called as Anuman Praman. In Bombay language, it means tukka, guesswork, right? Or your ability to speculate. And, just like I was telling you sometime back, the Darwin's theory, it starts with the word, I think. So the thought process of Darwin, you know, is his personal anuman, and it need not be the truth. The Big Bang theory is again an anuman praman. That means somebody has guessed it. Maybe it is like this. That is called guesswork. Just like one time, there were 6 blind men who were trying to find how an elephant looks. Trying to understand how an elephant looks. This is a story we have heard in our childhood. One man caught the leg and he said the elephant looks like a tree. One man caught the tail and he said the elephant looks like a rope. Another man caught the ear and he said the elephant looks like a scoop. Another man caught the body and he said the elephant looks like a wall. Everyone is right, but to their limited understanding. When a wise man came who could see and he explained how the elephant is a combination of all these things and it's much more, then they could understand. Like one time, there were 3 doctors standing on top of a building, and they saw in front of them there was one man who was limping. So one doctor said, "I can guess what problem he has." He said, "This man has a neuro disorder, therefore he's limping like this." The second doctor said, "No, it's not like a neuro disorder. This fellow has an orthopedic problem." The third doctor, he was a physiotherapist. He said he has a muscular spasm, therefore he's limping like this. So they called the man on top later. They asked him, "Why are you limping like this?" He said, "My Bata chappal broke just now." This is anuman praman. Speculate. You can speculate what you want. So therefore, guesswork need not be a perfect way of understanding the knowledge. And what to speak of understanding about God? If anybody can guess, then everybody's guess will be something different. Right? And whose guess is right? We have to guess whose guess is right. Therefore, anuman praman is not necessarily a perfect way of gaining knowledge. This is not just about God. This is about anything in this world. Pratyaksha praman and anuman praman. These are not perfect ways of gaining knowledge. The third thing, and more than anything else, because of this anuman and pratyaksha praman, things will keep changing. If you believe in pratyaksha praman and you believe in anuman praman, you will not get fixed knowledge which is eternally the same. The knowledge will change according to as understanding develops. The third way of gaining knowledge is called as Shabda Praman. This is the most powerful way of gaining knowledge, and this is called hearing from the right authority. Shabda, it means word of authority. Just like if you hear a radio and you hear news coming out from the radio, you understand that every word that is coming out from the radio is the truth. Why? Because that radio is connected to an authorized channel, and you can believe it. If the radio person, from the radio the news comes that there is a tsunami going on somewhere in some part of the world, you don't have to go there and verify. You know it is the truth. Why? Because this person is representing an authority who is going to report. You can believe it blindly. Similarly, when we want to gain knowledge about God, there is an authority whose words we can believe in. And that authority is the one who is giving us the message about God. And how do you understand such an authority is truth, is true? You understand that the authority is true because he comes in a disciplic succession, in a parampara. There is a connection. Just like one teacher learns from another teacher. That teacher learns from another teacher. That teacher learns from another teacher. That is called succession. And when the knowledge comes in a succession format, that knowledge can be considered as perfect knowledge. Why? Because it's coming in authority. Just like somebody who is an electrical engineer, he understands that B.L. Thareja, if anybody is an electrical engineer, you understand this word B.L. Thareja represents an authority. If he writes anything about electrical engineering, that is the truth. You don't go and start verifying what he's written. You accept it as truth because you know that he has a certain authority. Similarly, law. There are certain authorities who are authorities in law. If his name is there or her name is there, we know that it is the truth. Similarly, when we want to acquire knowledge about God, the authority in explaining to us about God is the scriptures. Now, the question comes, why should I accept an authority? Why should I accept an authority? Let us analyze. And then I'll talk about why should you accept the scriptures. Okay? I'm going to go about 5-6 minutes more. Is that fine? It's just 9 now. So, I'm going to give an example. Like for example, if somebody wants to know how to cook rasgullas, how do you know how to cook rasgullas? There are 3 ways to know how to cook a rasgulla. First is called pratyaksha praman. Go into the kitchen, anything white you get, take it together, you know, put it, you know, kind of mix things together and you make something which looks like a rasgulla. The second way is trying to guess how to make a rasgulla nice and beautiful and succulent. The third way is catch a cook. And the cook will explain to you how to make a rasgulla. You can make the best of rasgullas. I learned to make rasgullas in 2 days when there was an expert cook teaching me to make rasgullas. And now, to make rasgulla soft, you need to become an expert. You need to ask, what is the secret? If you, you know, take too much time to break the milk, to, you know, make the milk into paneer, rasgulla becomes too soft. If you do it immediately when it's too hot, then it becomes too hard. You should know exactly when to do it. You cannot speculate what is the right time. You have to know. That is the word of authority. And therefore, when knowledge comes from the word of authority, then we can understand it is perfect knowledge. Now, the question is, do we have blind faith in an authority? No. We do not have blind faith, but rather we have reasonable faith. And what is reasonable faith? Reasonable faith means that we test the authority and we understand what he's saying. When you test properly and you understand properly, then you get the perfect knowledge. Now, the next question is, on what basis should one put faith in the scriptures? And many people say that how and why should I put faith in the scriptures? The first reason why we should put faith in the scriptures is because the scriptures give us historical information. And these historical information have been proven to be truth. The first historical information, I'm going to give you many examples. What do you call geography in Hindi? Bhugol. What is the meaning of Bhugol? Bhugol means earth is round. That is what the scriptures have been saying forever. And then there is speculation. Earth may be flat, earth may be this, earth may be that. Why to speculate? This is a fact that is given. The development of the embryo, the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam gives detailed explanation of the step-by-step development of the embryo, right from the time of conception to the time of birth. Detailed. One time, I analyzed the descriptions of the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, with what is there in the science books. You will not believe it, month by month, perfect an explanation. And there are verses in the Bhagavatam which explain this. Cow dung. The antiseptic properties of cow dung have been, you know, spoken from time immemorial. And recently, science has accepted the antiseptic properties of cow dung. And they're using it for many medicines. Plants have life. Who said this? J.C. Bose. But the scriptures have always been talking about it. So we don't need somebody to scientifically verify which is already verified and which is a information available in the scriptures, right? These are some of the facts. There are hundreds of more facts. The second reason why we should put faith in the scriptures is because scriptures are like instruction manuals. Just like when you buy a mobile or when you buy a car, when you buy a washing machine, you get a manual along with it. And what does the manual tell you? How to make optimum use of that device. Without reading the manual, you can continue using the device. But you cannot make optimum use of it. You cannot use all the functions of it and make the best use of it. So similarly, human body is like a machine. And along with the machine comes the manual. How to use this machine in the best way, the most perfect way. And if somebody reads the manual, then he can make best use of the machine. The third reason why we should put faith in the scriptures, very interesting reason, is because the scriptures have many predictions, and these predictions have come perfectly true. There is a prediction of Gautam Buddha hundreds of thousands of years back, 5,000 years back. The Srimad Bhagavatam speaks about the Gautam Buddha, speaks about his father's name, his mother's name, the place where he'll be born. And 2,500 years back, Gautam Buddha was born. The scriptures talk about Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was born 500 years back, and the scriptures written 5,000 years back. The scriptures predict Chanakya Pandit thousands of years back, predicted. The scriptures predict Chandragupta Maurya, King Ashok. The scriptures also predict people like Jesus Christ. The Bhavishya Puran describes about Jesus Christ. The Bhavishya Puran also talks about Prophet Muhammad. So now, if these predictions are happening thousands of years back, they have been written down, and they're happening now, and much later, more than anything else, the scriptures also talk about what is going to happen in the future. It is explained that food will be sold in Kali Yuga. When it was written, never there was a concept of sale of food. It was written in the scriptures. It's written that in the scriptures that people's lifespans will decrease. And when a person becomes 20 years old, he'll be considered a grand old man. And there's also prediction about how people having long hair will be considered very fashionable. You know, so many descriptions are already there about the future also. And then it is also described that in future, as Kali Yuga progresses, men will eat their own fetuses. South Korea, it's already started happening. These are things that have been unheard of in the past. And how is it happening now? So these three things give us the faith that yes, we can have faith in the scriptures. So let us just conclude by revising everything that we have studied, and then we can have question answers, we can have prasad. I'm sorry, a little delayed. The first thing we spoke about, proof for the existence of God. First one, creation implies a creator. Second proof, laws imply a lawmaker. Third proof, organization and order. The fourth proof is design, which implies a intelligent designer. We saw two definitions of God. First definition of God, it is called spec, S-P-E-C. Supreme source of everything, supreme proprietor, supreme enjoyer, and supreme controller. The second definition of God is Bhagavan, the one who has six opulences in full. What are the six opulences? Wealth, strength, beauty, knowledge, fame, and renunciation. And then we saw that if we want to see God, how to see God? We saw the theory of cause and effect. The unseen can be proven by the seen. And then we saw that there are three methods of acquiring knowledge about God. This is called PAS. The first one is Pratyaksha Praman, which is with our perception. And there are four defects in the Pratyaksha Praman. What are the four defects? Imperfect senses, tendency to be illusion, third one, tendency to commit mistakes, and the cheating propensity. And then we saw that the second type of process, method to acquire knowledge is Anuman Praman, which is guesswork. And then we saw the third type is called as Shabda Praman, which is the word of authority. And then we saw how the scriptures are the written word of God. Anything which is written by a human being has to undergo change. I was telling about amendments in law. I was telling about scientific understandings of life. Scientific understandings, so many things. Change is always happening. But the scriptures have never been changed. As it is, they are presented. And even now, they are applicable as much they were applicable thousands of years back. Therefore, we can have more faith on them. Then why we can have faith in scriptures? Three reasons I spoke. First is historical evidences. We saw about life in plant, embryo development, so many things. Second one is instruction manuals. And the third one is predictions. So many predictions that the scriptures have done. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. So we will continue the discussion tomorrow. So right now we are stopping at the point where we are saying that God does exist. And we also have defined who God is very clearly. And we also have said that to understand God deeper and better, we need the help of scriptures, which are the written word of God. And if we base our knowledge based on the scriptures, then we can get perfect knowledge. Tomorrow onwards, we are going to build up from this point. We have accepted the scriptures as a basis of knowledge. Tomorrow onwards, we'll be building up from the point that what does the scriptures teach us? The basics. And the first question that we will ask is, who am I? We'll try to understand ourselves first, then we'll try to understand everything else. Yes. Yeah, once again, before that, the session is over. All of y'all can go outside, get your plates, be at comfort. I'm going to be sitting here and answering questions. Anybody has any questions, you can come up. Yeah, so the question is, are we going to have a session on ego? We will have a session on ego, but not in these six sessions. The first session when we start the Advanced Gita course will be the session on dealing with the ego and the mind. It's called mind happiness with mind management. That is the first session. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Tomorrow. Sunday. 7 o'clock. Same time. We have.